Welcome back to the programme. Now, Hong Kong, as you heard them talking there in the headlines, is currently experiencing its worst political crisis in decades. During the week, the chief executive, Carrie Lam, invoked emergency powers to ban protesters from wearing face masks. The move was a bid to end months of violent demonstrations, but instead saw thousands of protesters returning to the streets. I'm joined now by Aaron McNicholas, who's a freelance journalist in Hong Kong. Aaron, what is the situation like right now? And I understand that the city ground to a halt yesterday.
The city essentially grounded to a halt yesterday with every single subway station, with the sole exception of the Airport Express, being shut down. That is because on Friday night we saw scenes of mass vandalism and mass unrest hours after Carrie Lam announced this ban on face masks. Half of the network was still closed at the break of dawn this morning, and even more of them have been closed afresh by the time we get to the evening today. So the city in that sense has very much ground to a halt. Protesters have continued to flood the streets wearing their masks as if nothing has changed since Friday. But the anger is there, and it's actually gotten worse, because it's not even just about the simple fact of a face mask ban. It's about the fact that emergency laws were invoked. They were not put through Hong Kong's local parliament. And that essentially means that although Carrie Lam did not say directly that Hong Kong is in a state of emergency, she is invoking the power that is there to pass emergency laws without going through parliamentary scrutiny. So the question on everyone's mind is, if you can ban face masks that way, what else can you do? Can you monitor communications? Can you shut down instant messaging apps? Can you do all of these things that would be a lot more draconian than a face mask ban and could in theory be done under this emergency regulation?
But they can shut down those apps, can't they? Because I understand if you go on to mainland China now, that a lot of what you use in your normal life just doesn't exist.
That is the heart and the principle of one country, two systems, which is the constitutional principle that Hong Kong is supposed to be governed by. Yes, it is part of China under one country, but it has a separate system. And that is why when you come to Hong Kong, you can use Google, you can use Facebook, you can use Twitter, all of these things that are not allowed to be used on mainland China, but can be used without hindrance in Hong Kong. They can still be used without hindrance in Hong Kong today, and they will continue to do so. And I would imagine that there's no immediate risk to any of the big tech companies, but on the more secure messaging apps that protesters are using to communicate, there is widespread fear, whether it is founded or unfounded, that that will be one of the next things that might happen under this emergency regulation.
Right. I mean, when Chris Patten negotiated the changeover, it was to be one country, two systems for 50 years. Listen, we've been watching this and it's ticking away kind of in our consciousness. Well, it might stop ticking now. Have we lost the line? We have. Yeah. OK, let me go. Let me go, if I may, to Peter. We'll see if we can get him back, because I'm joined by Peter Hamilton, who's Assistant Professor of Modern Chinese History at Trinity College Dublin. Peter, I mean, I know that you know your territory here and that the plan was one country, two systems. No question who is the stronger partner. I mean, partner doesn't even enter into it. Why hasn't Beijing moved? What is the plan? What is the why is Hong Kong still so important to it? Is it for political reasons or commercial reasons or international trading reasons or money reasons or capitalism reasons?
I would say all of the above. China is very cautious about any kind of recurrence of the Tiananmen incident, as it's known. And so much of the security apparatus that has developed inside mainland China since then is designed to prevent such a crisis from ever occurring again. For Beijing to authorize some kind of direct military intervention into Hong Kong, things would have to be a lot worse, I think, than they are now. They're very aware of the severe moral, soft power, foreign policy, economic repercussions that would ensue from such an intervention, and are wisely cautious of kind of the unknown variables there. It would open a huge can of worms, as we say, that and probably be broadcast around the world on every phone and screen.
Yeah, which they wouldn't like, but they'd put up with it. I mean, they did Tiananmen Square. Now, you're not allowed to talk about it. And if you raise it in an interview with anybody when you're there, they look over their shoulder with fear in their eyes as if they didn't know what you were talking about. And it doesn't come up in any of the official histories, but we saw it on television.
Exactly. And even then, there was very significant disagreement within the party about that move. Very strong opposition within the military, within other high-level cabinet and state council positions. So we can be confident that there would be significant disagreement even now about that. And the as you brought up, there's just so many ways in which Hong Kong is still very important to China. It's still China's most important financial center, even though it's comparatively less than it was before. It's still a very important node of financial transactions, of trade, of legal accounting, et cetera, professional services. And you would have to accept that all of those could go haywire if you intervened militarily. And what would that mean to them?
I mean, because in a funny way, they can kind of work this agreement. But as I understand from the world of money and capitalism and trading and all of that, that Hong Kong is kind of useful to them?
Very useful. Very, very useful. So many of the international companies that operate in China operate through Hong Kong. Many Chinese companies like Lenovo and Haier are actually legally Hong Kong companies. You know, there's all sorts of invisible systems that Hong Kong facilitates in terms of China's economy, as well as more surreptitious things like money, getting money out of China, etc.
Of course, yeah. Which if you're a senior party person, you say that autonomy has been shifting in recent years in Hong Kong, and you give the example of education.
Yes. Yes.
Can you explain that?
That's part of what's fueling all of this, is a much longer history before the extradition bill of perceived creep by China in terms of influence behind the scenes into areas that are supposed to be autonomous. So the example of education is a good one, in which that's supposed to be a local issue decided by the Hong Kong government and still technically is on paper. But the introduction a few years ago of a proposed patriotic education curriculum was seen as Beijing's kind of creeping hand, trying to intervene in local matters and steer people towards accepting China and China's influence. And as with the extradition bill, then protests successfully got it shelved. But in all over the place in terms of money, in terms of Hong Kong government policy, in terms of its attitude towards the press, and now with things like the extradition bill, people perceive at least creeping mainland Chinese influence. It is,
but they're not
surprised,
are they? Are they surprised?
I don't think they're surprised anymore, but I think that people are disappointed. You know, we're nowhere near close to 2047, and kind of that looming horizon that is unknown about Hong Kong's future. We're still decades away from there.
Right. Well, I was there. I was working there when Chris Patten was there just before the changeover, and people in Hong Kong were absolutely petrified. They really were at that stage. They didn't know what was going to happen in terms of their human rights. And I think while they didn't think 50 years was a very long time, because people in that neck of the woods take a longer view than we do here. Listen, I want to go back to Aaron McNicholas, who's in Hong Kong. Aaron, how clear and articulate is the focus of all of this demonstration? Gone again. No?
Hello, Aaron.
Oh, there he is, yeah. in the sense that it started off on extradition. What's it about now? Sorry, Donoghue, you wanted to come in?
Yeah, I mean, from the Chinese perspective, when they got Hong Kong in 1997, it was a big economic prize. But within that, there was kind of like the threat of a democratic virus that might spread to other parts of China. It was only a few years after the Tiananmen Square massacre, I'll call it that rather than an incident. And, you know, they were very also conscious of what happened in the Soviet Union. I mean, Gorbachev introduced democratic and economic reforms at the same time. So at the same time that people were hurting because of reform, democracy gave them the opportunity to articulate that. And the end was the collapse of the Soviet Union. So the Chinese adopted a different way.
They let loose the purse strings, but not the headstrings.
Absolutely. So they kept control of politics, whereas they are now a hyper-capitalist system. They're not communist in anything but name.
Yeah.
And that's why Hong Kong is so important. That's why it's like a Trojan horse almost for democracy. And they have to treat it warily. They don't want to go back to the Tiananmen Square massacres, but also it's a signal to where they're at politically. And also, of course, there are other parts of China which get much less coverage, places like the Uyghurs in Western China, to Tibetans, of course. And of course, they're trying to get Taiwan back, so to speak. So how they treat Hong Kong also sends a message to others who are looking for autonomy and more freedoms in China.
Right. You were in the Soviet Union. Well, in Russia, sorry.
When it was breaking up.
Yes.
The most amazing thing is I was there learning Russian and you were unaware the country was breaking up. It's really funny. You know, people outside knew a hell of a lot more about what was going on than we did who were in Russia. But in terms of Hong Kong, I think Hong Kong is incredibly important to China because it allows China, gives China the permission to suggest that it is tolerant of various different arrangements, let's say.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing is that, you know, ideas are contagious. In the same way as diseases are contagious, ideas are contagious. Democracy, this idea of personal freedom, it's a very attractive, contagious idea. And I suppose the Chinese really need to be able to try and suppress it sufficiently that it doesn't gain any toehold in China. The interesting thing about the internet, you're absolutely right. I mean, I've been to China a good few times. China controls the internet. It switches it on and off. You know, everyone says, oh, the internet's multinational and you can't control it. You can if you want. And they have shown, and also their own Facebook, WeChat, is much more sophisticated than anything Facebook have. They're a much more technologically savvy population than the United States. Their technology is incredibly advanced. But there is a sort of, it seems to me when you're there, that there's a sort of a social contract between the state and the people, which is, here's the parameters within which we can operate. Don't go over to the extreme because it'll attract heat. And I think the most interesting thing about the whole Chinese story is how phenomenally important China is to the whole world.
Yep.
I was in Africa recently and I asked a taxi driver, what's the biggest change? This was in South Africa. And I was expecting to say Afrikaners or whites or Mandela. And he said, the Chinese dudes. He said, they're everywhere, right? And I asked him, and he said, they're trading, they're buying, they're selling, they're building infrastructure.
They've bought up Zimbabwe.
All that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. So what we have is we've got China operating what you could call kind of checkbook diplomacy. So they're buying influence all over the world. Also, don't forget that state capitalism a la China with the genuflection to democracy is actually the policy that suits vast majority of the world. So if you go for a walk from Shanghai to Istanbul, long I'll walk now, in fairness, you won't meet a democracy, like a liberal democracy.
Yeah.
You have state democracy, you have state capitalism, all the way through. So our idea that what we do is sacrosanct, or is in some way more superior, nonsense.
Right. Well, and you only have to look out the door more or less to see that. Here, I'm going to have one last go to Aaron McNicholas. Just on that question that this started about extradition, what's it about now?
Well, first of all, let me apologise for the connection
problem.
That's
okay.
You're correct, absolutely correct. This started as an argument over extradition, but that was only the flashpoint that triggered a wide variety of discontent coming to the surface, not for the first time. About a few days, up to a week or so after the very first protest in June, there were five demands articulated relating to what Hong Kong protesters want to see. The biggest one of those, of course, is this idea of universal suffrage, one person, one vote, which Hong Kong has never seen, whether it has been under British rule or Chinese rule. When the handover was happening in the lead up to 1997, Hong Kong people were promised that they would be able to elect their own leader in time, in a gradual and orderly way, is what the Chinese government were, how they phrased this. But in 2014, 5 years ago, we found out exactly what Beijing had in mind when it comes to how Hong Kong people would elect their own leader. And that was, yes, it can be one person, one vote, but the two or three candidates that you will have on the ballot paper will be chosen by a committee of maybe 1,200 people. And that committee system was widely perceived to be in favor of Beijing's interests. So essentially, there was a screening process there which would have prevented it to be a genuine democratic framework. And that caused a huge protest movement 5 years ago. And we're at this situation again. Although universal suffrage is just but one of the demands, it is something that will continually cause unrest in Hong Kong until it is adequately resolved. Also, since this has started 4 months ago, there have been numerous incidences in terms of how the police have handled the operation, which rightly or wrongly has given rise among the protesters to a feeling that the police are not impartial and that they are not acting within the boundaries of the law. Whether that's right or wrong is a question that we can ask, but in 4 months there are numerous incidences that have given rise to this belief. So when you go out on the streets now, what you're going to hear is anger towards the police, a feeling that they're not being impartial in executing their duty. And just in the last week or two, you've started to hear chants of disbanding the police force. Now, we can go back to our own national history and think about how long it took for the RUC to be disestablished. And we think to ourselves, well, it's only been 4 months in Hong Kong. We're not at that point yet, of course. But that is a chance that you're starting to hear now. And it just goes to show just how angry some of these people are.
It is so difficult from a distance, and very often things start off as a kind of a natural outburst by people and demonstration. But it's very hard to keep that going without organisation and focus and planning and all those kinds of things. It can't be spontaneous all the time, or can it?
Certainly the police think they're dealing with a situation where there's a large majority of relatively peaceful protesters and then a smaller minority of non-peaceful protesters that must be organized in some way. My discussions with those frontline protesters who are willing to use some degree of violence would suggest that they don't have what you might call a central command. They're simply operating in small groups of 10 or 20, and they are sharing ideas with each other and coordinating a little bit, but there's no one leader telling those few hundred or few thousand non-peaceful protesters, this is what we'll do this week, this is what methods we'll use, so now we'll go ahead and do that. There certainly has been a perception that's been holding up that this is a leaderless protest movement. And certainly for the really hardcore protesters who are willing to use some degree of violence, their attitude is, if you have a leader, that leader will be found, will be arrested, and you can't have a situation in their eyes where if one person gets arrested, then everything falls apart. So that is their perception, and that is why this is continuing on.
And not to be excessively crass, how are they earning a crust if they've been protesting for 4 months? Like, how do you buy the groceries? By the way, I gather the supermarkets have been stripped of groceries.
It would be a bit premature to say they've been stripped of groceries. Certainly in the last few days and since the face mask ban has been announced, the major supermarket chains have been closing early, much earlier than normally, and there has been a rush in certain areas for people to buy goods before those early closures take effect. But it would be a little premature to suggest that there is massively empty shelves in every single supermarket
right.
in Hong
okay.
Kong.
Okay.
That is a bit of an exaggeration, but certainly it wasn't the case 2 or 3 months ago that supermarkets were closing their doors earlier. That is a relatively new development just in the last 3 days. And it does really start to feel like that from that point of view, that the unrest is escalating.
What was the reaction in Hong Kong as they observed the 70 years celebrations in mainland China?
Well, a few weeks before that, we had a leaked audio recording from Carrie Lam, which was later obtained by the Reuters news agency and distributed. And she said at that point, this was, I think, about late August, she said that there was still a plan to have an October 1st celebration, but she had no expectation that the protests would be over by then. So she had very low expectation for what kind of modest or relatively muted celebration would be possible in Hong Kong on October 1st. There was a short, solemn ceremony in the morning on October 1st, certainly not with the same pomp and circumstance and fancy presentation that we were used to in previous years, and the normal fireworks display that happens every year in Hong Kong on October 1st, that did not go ahead. That was cancelled. So the presentation of the day was quite muted compared to previous years. And of course, naturally, we had people still coming out into the streets and expressing their discontent. And October 1st, as you will have seen from the news reports, was also the first incident throughout this movement where a police officer did use his revolver to shoot a protester in order to,
with
a live round, from the point of view of the police officer, in order to save his own life and the lives of his colleagues. And that was the explanation that was given. But that was still the first time throughout this movement that a protester was shot.
May I go back to Peter, please? Peter, how do they handle the other autonomous regions? I mean, there was the whole business of Tibet, and by God, they nailed that one down. If you disagree with the authorities, they're not shy about showing you their displeasure. And yet, I think things have eased in Tibet. And then there were other autonomous regions. There's the one, I can't remember the name of it, where the first port of call, so to speak, when you go on to the mainland.
Yeah, they're all different. We have Hong Kong, Macau, Xinjiang, the Muslim majority districts in the northwest, and Tibet. And all are governed quite differently from one another. Hong Kong, in that sense, has been very privileged. Tibet and Xinjiang have not enjoyed the same freedoms of speech, press, etc., religion that Hong Kong has for so many years, even since 1997. The special economic zones, like Shenzhen, are economically different than the rest of mainland China, but not in terms of political or legal rights that are different.
Yeah. Well, it's all very interesting. There's a kind of a nervousness around that this can't go on forever and ever. Mary, can I just come to you before I go to the break on this? In your diplomatic life, have you had an involvement with China?
Yeah, the first time I went to Beijing was sometime in the 1980s, and the last time I went before I retired was about 2014, and it was absolutely amazing to see the transformation. And whereas Hong Kong, the first time we went out with them, we went through Hong Kong, and Hong Kong was New York to backwater that was Beijing, and by the 2014, the situation was totally changed. And I think one must acknowledge that what China has done, it has lifted millions, billion people probably out of poverty.
Yeah.
And it has certainly been a force of
having
stability.
Having killed how many tens of millions in the Cultural Revolution. Yeah.
But I do worry about Hong Kong now, because at some point there has to be a resolution or it won't be a policing matter anymore. And although one can criticise the police, it is still a situation being handled by the police.
Mm.
It seems to have developed its own momentum. It's not clear, as we've just heard, what the demands are. It's not clear if there's people that one can discuss the demands with, in a sense. I would wonder how much longer Carrie Lam will be there. I mean, she is reluctantly, I think, occupying that position. She doesn't
carry herself with authority.
She doesn't look like she really wants to be there.
Yeah.
And you would just wonder where it goes from here. I'm sure that Beijing would wish to sort this out in a way that preserved the the reality, maybe to some extent, of one country, two systems. And I don't think it would go the way of what has happened to the Uyghur people. Or I don't think that's possible, because the media will know what's going on in Hong Kong. So it's not like it's far away and out of sight. But I would worry if this continues. And I was very struck when Aaron started speaking first, he referred to mass vandalism and mass unrest. Now, maybe that was a slip of the tongue, but even the word mass vandalism suggests a situation where civil control is
And apparently away. That is the nightmare for Beijing, that kind of chaos. Anyway, listen, May, I thank you both very, very much indeed for that. Aaron McNicholas, who is in Hong Kong at the moment, and Peter Hamilton, Assistant Professor of Modern Chinese History. Thank you very much indeed, and we'll take a break.
Podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.